So this is the Theravada vehicle. So remember, this comes from the Four Noble Truths teachings and spread from India through the Pali language into Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Southeast Asia. So in these traditions, the goal is liberation from samsara, the goal of nirvana. Then we have the goal of enlightenment. And someone who achieves the goal of enlightenment, of course, is the Buddha. And the vehicle that can get us to the goal of enlightenment is now commonly called Mahayana. In the modern day world, the various Buddhist traditions that present the final goal of the path is enlightenment. So that includes Chinese Buddhism, Zen, Korean, Vietnamese, and Tibetan Buddhism. These Buddhist traditions say that the final goal of the Buddhist spiritual path is enlightenment. So these traditions collectively now are called Mahayana. Yana is vehicle. Maha means great. So it's the vehicle that can take us to the great goal of enlightenment. Now, of course, we have to develop an aspiration for this goal of enlightenment. And the aspiration that we cultivate is called bodhicitta. Because at this level here, we develop this renunciation, this aspiration for nirvana, for liberation from suffering. So this is really compassion for ourselves. This aspiration is really compassion for ourselves. But then we can understand, well, everyone else is stuck in the same situation as me. So we can go on and build on this aspiration and go, I also want to help liberate everyone else from suffering as well. But then we can see, well, in my current state, I can't really help anyone else very much because I've got all my own issues to deal with. How can I best help others overcome suffering? Is if I myself achieve full awakening, if I myself achieve enlightenment, then I can really be helpful to others. This is bodhicitta. So bodhi is Sanskrit for enlightenment. Chitta is mind. So bodhicitta is the mind of enlightenment. It's the mind which aspires to enlightenment so that we can help to liberate everyone else from suffering as well. If we develop this aspiration, we are called a bodhisattva. So of course, bodhisattva is also a Sanskrit word. Again, bodhi is enlightenment. Sattva has many meanings. Here, sattva means courage or strength. So a bodhisattva is someone who has the courage or strength to strive for enlightenment, for the benefit of others. So the bodhisattva then strives for enlightenment, and when a bodhisattva achieves enlightenment, they become Buddha. So how can we achieve enlightenment? What are the practices that we need to engage in? So what's the medicine that we need to engage in to achieve enlightenment? So normally here in the Mahayana, the normal presentation you will see here is what's called the six perfections. As we saw in the chart here with the Theravada, we can see the six perfections. So these are the six core practices that we need to engage in to achieve enlightenment. And so here we see them listed as generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, wisdom. So maybe I can, because in your red booklet they are explained in more detail, But maybe I can just mention briefly what each of them are. Generosity is defined in Sanskrit, in Pali, dana. Generosity is defined as the intention to give. And generally here we can talk about at least four types of giving. The first is to give material things, food, money, so forth, clothing. Then, of course, also we can give protection. We can help to protect people from danger, from fear, from being afraid of things. Then we can give love or loving kindness. We can be generous in that way. And finally, the fourth one is what's called give dharma. Dharma simply means here advice and guidance. To help others, giving advice and guidance to them. So this is generosity. Ethics here, as with Theravada, the core is abandoning harmful, non-virtuous behaviour. But here in the Mahayana, ethics is also more proactive. Ethics here is not just avoiding harmful behaviour, but ethics includes the ethics of engaging in virtue and the ethics of helping others. That's also ethics. Patience, as we saw earlier, is not a behaviour. Patience is not just sit there and do nothing. This is not patience. Again, patience is a mental attitude. Patience is defined as a mind, an undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation. So what patience means is, whatever the situation, remain calm and clear so that we can better evaluate what's going on, so we have a better chance of responding in a better way. This is patience. The fourth one is joyous effort. Here, often when people see that we need to apply effort in everything, but often here, sometimes people turn this into the spiritual practice into a hardship that they have to endure. If we see spiritual practice as a hardship that we have to endure, we've completely missed the point. Because here, joyous effort is defined as a mind that delights in virtue, meaning a mind that is happy to do good things. So if we're happy to do good things, no matter how difficult they are, it becomes effortless, because we're happy to do it. This is something very important in spiritual practice. If any spiritual practice, we see it as some sort of hardship that we have to endure, we've completely missed the point. To overcome that, what we really need to do is reflect on the benefits of that practice that we're doing. If we can see that that practice is going to give us a lot of benefit, we're going to joyfully do it, no matter how difficult it is. That's joyous effort. So really, if we want our practice to go well, even if it's difficult, we need to cultivate this joyous attitude, really being happy, joyful to do this, no matter how difficult. Because otherwise, if we turn it into a hardship, we're just going to give up. And then we're not really appreciating. We're probably doing the practice because someone told us to do it, rather than understanding that it's going to benefit us.
Did the Buddha have a definition for spirituality or spiritual practice? Or is that just a term?
Okay. Related to that, often people ask, is Buddhism a religion? And to answer that, you have to ask, what's your definition of the word religion? And I remember reading an article not so long ago where a modern-day scholar did research, and he said that in our modern day there are at least four different definitions of the word religion. And when I looked at those definitions, according to two of them, Buddhism was a religion, and according to two of them, it was not. So one of the definitions was of religion was the belief in some sort of creator God. according to that definition, of course, Buddhism is not a religion. And I think one of the definitions was more about some system that believes there's something more than this material world, that there's some higher thing. For that, yes. And I can't remember what the other two were, but there are at least four major different definitions of the word religion in use today in the world. So in that sense, we have to understand what do we mean by that, whether Buddhism is not a religion or not.
But I mean in terms of the word spiritual.
Again, what do you mean by spiritual?
I'm asking if the Buddha used that term.
Well, I've never seen that word in any text.
Okay, so that's just a term.
It's just a term.
A general term.
I mean, I think often when people use the word spiritual, often they have an idea, a sense of some higher thing than just the material world. In that sense, you could say Buddhism is spiritual. But again, it would completely depend on how you define the word spiritual. But I've never actually seen that word as a translation of any term in Buddhism. Okay. I'll just... Let me finish and then some questions. So the fifth of the six perfections is concentration. So here again, samadhi. And here in the Mahayana, the concentration practice is usually called shamatha practice because that's the level of concentration we are trying to develop. Again, in the Theravada, usually concentration practice is called jhana practice, achieving the jhanas. And wisdom practice, again, prajna, Sanskrit, vipassana. So if we look at those six perfections, then we can also condense the six perfections into the same three core areas of practice. We can subsume generosity, ethics, and patience as ethics. Concentration we have, wisdom we have, and then joyous effort is something we need to apply to all of them. So also in the Mahayana, like the Theravada, we have the same three core areas of practice. Ethics, concentration, wisdom. But here in the Mahayana, when we talk about wisdom practice or vipassana practice, we're mainly talking about gaining this wisdom of emptiness here. In Sanskrit, shunyata. So in the Mahayana, of course, as with the Theravada, we need to realize impermanence, dukkha, and no self. But in the Mahayana, it's accepted that there is a deeper level of ignorance going on than merely this grasping onto self. At the deepest level, according to the Mahayana, the fundamental ignorance we suffer from is grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. So we need, in our Vipassana practice, to realize there's no independent me, no independent world. This is emptiness. Emptiness is the fact that everything is empty of existing independently. But again, we're not saying there's no me and no world. So the question is not whether I and the world exist or not. The question is, how do I exist and how does the world exist? And the Mahayana says, me and the world do not exist independently. That's emptiness. The flip side of that, of course, is, therefore, if we exist and we don't exist independently, we exist dependently. What that really means, we're going to talk about in detail tomorrow. So here, in Mahayana, when we talk about Vipassana practice, we're mainly talking about gaining this realization of emptiness. Of course, on the basis of realizing impermanence, dukkha, and no self. So this is the Mahayana vehicle. And again, the traditions that follow the Mahayana vehicle in the modern world now are Chinese Buddhism, Zen, Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese, Tibetan Buddhism. Someone first had a hand up a long time ago, yeah.
Is the question that goes back to the aspiration of the Bodhisattva? So does the Bodhisattva, because they have the courage to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, when they attain enlightenment, is that why the Buddha kept teaching? Like, he was a classic Bodhisattva because he remained...
Yeah.
Because if you attain enlightenment and then you disperse...
Yeah. So...
Is it just that your subtle energy is enlightened and therefore it's benefiting all beings? Or is it...
Sure.
What's that? How direct are you benefiting?
Right. Now... Here, as I mentioned briefly, there are different philosophical systems within Buddhism. And the philosophical systems that are mainly followed in the Theravada assert that when someone becomes an arhat, or when Prinsiddhartha became a Buddha, and their life ended, then they disappear without a trace. The philosophical systems that the various schools of Buddhism and the Mahayana follow would not agree with that. In fact, they would say that's illogical for that to happen. So in the Mahayana, what they say is that if someone becomes an arhat or a Buddha, and then this body in that life finishes, it's not like it disappears. What the Mahayana would say is that someone who's become an arhat finishes this life is still not completed the spiritual path, because the next step is to become a Buddha. So that arhat then would eventually manifest again, not in samsara, but they do more work and become Buddha. And then the whole purpose, as you said, of becoming a Buddha was so that you can effectively help to liberate others from suffering. So the Mahayana assertion is that in the Buddha, a person who's enlightened will continue to appear and manifest in the world again and again and again forever, trying to help others to be free of suffering.
But must they teach like the Buddha did? Because the Buddha spent 40 years teaching.
It really depends a lot on the circumstances, the environment. Because actually, I could imagine that if someone like Prinsiddhartha appeared in our world today, in our modern society, they may be seen as some sort of crazy person. Possibly, no? And that's often what we do. We see people who are, and there are crazy people, of course, but sometimes there are people who are very genuine and who've got something to offer, but because they're so different than what we expect, we look at them as some sort of crazy person. So I could imagine that if Prinsiddhartha were to appear here now, maybe he'd get locked up in a mental asylum. Possibly. I mean, seriously. So it would depend a little bit on the environment, how an enlightened person can appear to help.
But are there bodhisattvas today?
I mean, the Mahayana assertion, an implication of this is that technically, it could be the fact that in this room, I'm the only unenlightened person, and that you're all enlightened, pretending to be students to help me. Technically, this could be possible, according to the Mahayana. Caught you out, didn't I?
But after you define emptiness, meaning we are dependent and not independent in our existence, that's how I kind of understood no self. So can you explain
tomorrow,
the difference?
Okay. Tomorrow morning, I'll talk about the difference.
I got my answer.
Oh, okay.
If I think about rebirth,
yeah.
And you said that it is determined by karma, like cause and effect.
For a normal person.
Do you have any answer to why the Dalai Lama or, I don't know, higher beings or enlightened are always or mainly... get rebirth as men?
Again, they wanted to benefit. So ancient India, ancient Tibet were patriarchal societies. So if they were reborn as a woman in that society, no one would listen to them, would they? They wouldn't be able to benefit. In fact, recently in Delhi, the Dalai Lama was interviewed by a reporter, or for a newspaper, Indian, asking him, if it was more beneficial for you to come back as a woman in your next life, would you? And he said, definitely.
So definitely. Still today.
Definitely. So, therefore, it's all about benefit. And unfortunately, in ancient India, ancient Tibet, it was patriarchal society. But I think now actually it's flipped, because I was talking to someone yesterday about this, but, you know, I've been teaching here for 9 years and many other places, and I always like to keep an eye on the numbers, women to men. It's always 60% women, 40% men. Always. In all the 9 years I've been teaching here, every year is the same. So it seems like women have the big advantage over men in the modern world. Big advantage. For whatever reason, I'm not sure, but that seems to be the case. So, yes. Okay. Now, let's look at Vajrayana. So Vajrayana, or sometimes called Tantra, and here we need to be careful, of course. Here I'm talking about Buddhist Tantra. So the word Tantra is used in other systems, like Hindu Tantra and probably other systems called Tantra. So we should not assume they're the same. There may be some overlap, but I'm only talking here about Buddhist Tantra. And in Tantra, or Vajrayana, we have the same goal of practice, that is to achieve enlightenment, so that we can help everyone. And we develop the same aspiration of bodhicitta. And we're developing the same wisdom of emptiness. To achieve enlightenment in the Vajrayana Tantra path, we need to come to realize emptiness. So what's the difference between Vajrayana and Mahayana? The difference is the level of mind that we are using in the spiritual path. In the Theravada and Mahayana, we are using this coarse mind, the one we have now. We are trying to refine it through the shamatha concentration practice, and then we are using that in our vipassana practice to penetrate the nature of reality, to achieve the goal of nirvana or enlightenment. And this could take a long time, maybe many lives. As I mentioned briefly earlier, we can talk about at least three levels of mind: coarse, subtle, very subtle. The deeper the level of the mind, the more powerful. If we can gain access to this very subtle mind in meditation and use that to realize emptiness, we can accelerate the spiritual path. We can wipe out ignorance much more quickly. We can achieve enlightenment, in the best case, in this very life. Knowing that, in Tantra or Vajrayana, we have practices to help us to gain access to this very subtle mind. This very subtle mind sometimes is called the, as we saw in the death process, sometimes called the clear light mind. Sometimes, in other traditions, it's called primordial mind. In the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, they use the Tibetan word rikpa. It's given many different names. But we're talking about the very subtle mind. So how do we gain access to this very subtle mind is through these two practices here called the two stages. Generation stage, completion stage. Now, sometimes this Vajrayana or Tantra vehicle is called resultant vehicle. Theravada and Mahayana are both what's called causal vehicles. Meaning both of these have the perspective that I'm here now, there is the result of Nirvana enlightenment. What causes do I need to create to get to that goal? So both of these have a perspective of where we are now, looking forward. Vajrayana or Tantra has the complete opposite perspective. They have a perspective of the result. And this perspective is sometimes adopted in sport. Sometimes we see people who are going to do some sporting activity, they go through the process of doing it and having achieved their result, and then they do the activity. And that helps them to actually achieve the result, imagining that they've already achieved that result and then do the practice. Very powerful method used in sport a lot. Similarly here, what we're doing in Tantra Vajrayana is we are imagining having achieved the result and then doing the practice from that perspective is very powerful. That's why it's called resultant vehicle. So what we are doing is these two stages, generation stage, completion stage. In generation stage practice, we tend to do a practice according to what's called a sadhana, a practice manual. And in that practice manual, we go through a number of steps. And one of the first steps, of course, is to arise in a fully enlightened form at the beginning of the practice and then do the practice from that perspective. To be able to do this, we need to understand the Buddhist view of reality of emptiness. If we don't have an understanding and experience of emptiness, and we do this arising in the fully enlightened form, then there's a huge chance that we'll just boost the ego. I'm enlightened. I'm Buddha. I'm Chenrezig. I'm Tara. We're pretending to be enlightened. So if in this practice we have this idea, oh, now I'm pretending to be Chenrezig, now I'm pretending to be Tara, we've completely missed the point. And we're a big chance that we're just going to become delusional and boost the ego. The only way that this practice will work is if we have an understanding of emptiness. In fact, it's said that to enter into tantric practice, we need three things as a basis. We need renunciation. We need bodhicitta, meaning we need to have a good motivation for doing the practice and not doing the practice hoping to experience some sort of bliss. And we also need to have the view of emptiness. If we don't have these three things at some sort of level, then doing this practice won't really get us anywhere, and chances are it'll just boost the ego and we'll go completely astray in the spiritual path. But if we have the view of emptiness, then we can arise in that fully enlightened form and do the practice. And the practice often involves certain visualizations and chanting mantras and so forth. And also here, it at a deeper level, it involves doing concentration practice, shamatha practice. Because in completion stage practice, what we are doing is we are trying to cause the very subtle mind to become active, manifest. And we do that in completion stage practice by withdrawing all the subtle energies into the central channel and withdrawing all the subtle energies to the heart chakra. If we can do that in this meditation, we can cause the heart chakra to open and rest in that clear light mind, realizing emptiness, and then in the best case scenario, we can achieve enlightenment. So therefore, of course, To do this completion stage practice, we need the basis. Now, and that's why, and manipulating subtle energies, as I mentioned, I think, yesterday, we need to do this in a very controlled way. We need to have a good basis. Because if we don't, and we try to do these practices, one of two things will happen. Most likely nothing will happen because we have no ability to do anything. Or if we have just enough ability to start shifting some energies not in a controlled way, then, of course, remember the analogy yesterday of the rider and the horse? The subtle energy is the rider, the horse, the mind is the rider. So if we start moving subtle energies in an uncontrolled way, we are disturbing the subtle mind. And if we do that, not in a controlled way, we can create deep psychological disturbances that are very difficult to get to overcome. So this is not something to play with. And as a result, sometimes Tantra is called the secret vehicle. Meaning, generally, historically at least, you would never hear anything about Tantra, particularly this completion stage practice, you would never hear that in public. You would only ever receive those instructions from your personal teacher when they saw that you're ready to do the practice. Before that, you would never hear about it. That's why it's called secret vehicle. Because it's just going to cause problems otherwise. So this is Vajrayana. Now, Vajrayana, or Tantra, in India only really started to be widely practiced from about the 8th century onwards. And Buddhism had spread to most countries before that, except Tibet. Then Buddhism only came to Tibet from the 8th century onwards. So what we find is that the Buddhism that came to Tibet included this level of practice. So my understanding is now in the modern Buddhist traditions, the only modern Buddhist tradition that has a full, complete version of tantric practice is Tibetan Buddhism. So what we can understand from these three vehicles is they're not three different systems. They are three levels of practice. That if we want to practice Vajrayana, we need a basis in Mahayana. If we want to practice Mahayana, we need a basis in the Theravada. Does that mean we have to go to a Theravada country before we can practice Tibetan Buddhism? No. What it means is that in the Tibetan Buddhism, they have both levels of practice in the practice. And they start with these practices first, and then move on to these practices. So these are levels of practice, not different approaches. Any questions about any of this?
When the motivation in Mahayana is to get enlightened in order to benefit all sentient beings.
And also Vajrayana, same.
And the Theravada, only renunciation to reach Nirvana, is it like in Theravada they don't care about sentient beings?
I was hoping someone would ask this question. When we look at this, we go, wow, those Theravada people are pretty selfish, aren't they? If you have a selfish motivation, you won't get anywhere near Nirvana. Impossible. Impossible. As we're going to see now, actually, in both Theravada and Mahayana, we are cultivating loving kindness and compassion towards all living beings. A necessary basis for either achieving Nirvana or enlightenment. Without that, impossible. The difference being is a little bit the philosophy behind the tradition. Because remember here in the Theravada, it's accepted that when we achieve Nirvana and that life finishes, finished. So after becoming an Arhat, we may have 10, 20, 30 years where we can help a bit and then finished. So to have the aspiration to help liberate everyone from suffering would be illogical. How could we ever implement that in 10 or 20 or 30 years? Not possible. So it never really comes into mind to do that. But of course here, someone following this path would be trying to help others as much as they can, everyone. And they would be cultivating loving kindness and compassion towards everyone. The difference being is here, because of the understanding that we'll keep, after achieving enlightenment, we'll come back again and again and again. Here, in bodhicitta, not only are we trying to help everyone as much as we can, inbuilt in bodhicitta is we are making it our personal responsibility. I myself alone am going to help liberate everyone else from suffering. That's huge. That wouldn't even enter into this mind because it's not possible based on their philosophical understanding. It would be just illogical to try and even think like that. Because how can we do that in 10 years or 20 years or whatever time we have in our hearts? It's just not possible.
You said it's not necessary to be a vegetarian as when you practice Buddhism. What is that then in the Tantra tradition about being a vegetarian and not putting any intoxicants in?
Yeah, right. There's a couple of things here important. With each of these levels of practice, we have what's called vows or precepts, which are guidelines to help us to know what not to do and what to do, to help us. And these vows or precepts are often also part of that is ethical standard, ethical level, because all of them mean ethics. Each level we go up, the level of ethics we need to follow more difficult. More difficult. For example, in Vajrayana or Tantra, as part of the precept or vow to practice this, if we give up love, loving kindness, for even one single sentient being, this is considered a serious ethical downfall at this level of practice. Serious. If that happens here, okay, it's not good, but it's not a big problem. Here, it's a big problem. So the ethics that we have to follow here is much more stringent than either of those levels, contrary to popular belief. Often in our modern society, we feel like in Tantra, we've gone beyond ethics, we can do whatever we want. That's complete misunderstanding. At high levels of Tantric practice, we have this ability to transform. Like Theravada and particularly Mahayana, when we talk about mental afflictions, we talk about eliminating them because they're destructive, they're harmful. But in Tantra, because of the perspective coming from emptiness at a high level of Tantric practice, we can transform, or they what's called self-liberate, meaning that if some mental affliction were to arise, then instead of applying an antidote as we do here, we could just transform it into the positive opposite. Very difficult to do, but at the high level here, because what we need to remember is things like anger has a lot of energy, and so here we're trying to stop that. Here, we understand this is a lot of energy here, and if we can turn it into positive, we can harness that. And so that's what we do here at the high, very high level. We do that. We transform like anger into compassion or loving kindness, but it's not easy to do. And unfortunately, people who start to practice Tantra hear this and they go, and they get angry, they go, I'm transforming it, it's okay. And they're not, they're just completely deluding themselves. And so they say that because I'm a tantric practitioner, everything I do is ethical, everything's okay. Complete delusional.
From the stories, people that learned from the Buddha itself, not only Arahant. So I'm asking, what is coming from the Buddha and what is like developed through the years? And
yeah, so all the things I'm presenting, of course, are coming from the original teachings. But what, and I think I briefly mentioned this earlier, is that, of course, the Buddha taught different things to different people in different times. Thousands of teachings. And so if we as an individual wanted to know about a particular practice, it would be difficult to find all the times where he talked about that. I mean, we'd spend our whole life trying to find what the Buddha said about this particular practice in these thousands of sutras. Fortunately for us, the great Indian masters did this work for us. They collected all these bits of information and put them together. So when we talk about a particular practice like these, the descriptions of them will generally come from these great Indian masters who have assembled all these bits of information from the various teachings of the Buddha. But also what we need to remember, certainly from a Mahayana perspective, is that Prince Siddhartha is not the only person who became a Buddha in this world system now. That according to Mahayana, there are many people who have become enlightened since the time of the Buddha. So, of course, they would be equally valid teacher because they are the same level as the Buddha. Because sometimes people say, oh, no, no, we can't follow that person because we can only use the teachings of the historical Buddha. But then I think we're limiting ourselves, you know. Because if this person has achieved enlightenment in a society or culture closer to ours, maybe the way they present it is we can more easily relate to. But regardless of what text or we are reading or hearing from, we have to apply the same process as I mentioned right at the beginning of this course, is do not blindly accept anything merely out of devotion to that person. Rather, be like a goldsmith, check, test the quality of the gold. So whatever, even if it's coming directly from the Buddha, a sutra, or from Nagarjuna, Shantideva, or some other great Indian or Tibetan master, we need to apply the same test to it. Does this make sense? Is it going to be beneficial? And not just go, oh, the Buddha said so, it must be true. So this is very important.
What you were just saying about you know, this aspiration to liberate others kind of reminded me a little bit of the practice of prayer in other traditions. So I guess, you know, you often hear of people praying for people who are suffering around the world. And some people might say they actually do hope for divine intervention, but often it seems to be more about cultivating compassion.
Yeah.
Are there similarities and, like, are there similar differences
Between that and fact. In Tibetan Buddhism, we have a lot of something similar. And unfortunately, when people come in there, they look at them and go, oh, no, not that prayer stuff again. I was trying to get away from that, you know. But what we need to understand here is that particularly like in Tibetan Buddhism, when we talk about prayer, we're talking about aspiration. We're not saying, oh, let's hope that this person gets better. We have prayers like, may I achieve enlightenment so I can help people more. May I... So it's an aspiration. It's not just a blind wish that may everything be good. It's an actual aspiration, particularly for ourselves, to be able to do something to help. And that plants very powerful imprints in our mind. You know, as I think already mentioned, William James, modern-day philosopher, who said, what we attend to becomes our reality. So if we plant the seeds through prayer or aspiration or whatever name you want to give it, if we, like, particularly, we're going to talk about this day after tomorrow, finding a qualified teacher, if we really make a sincere aspiration, may I meet with a qualified teacher who can guide me in my practice, if we make that sincere aspiration, this is karma, this is imprint. This can ripen as meeting a qualified teacher. So this is the type of sort of prayer we're talking about here.
So there's like an actual causality.
It's, yeah, actual, rather than this blind, well, may all sickness be dispelled, you know. It's more a causality-based thing where then we can do something or like that. Okay. Yeah. Where what? Oh, so when Buddhism spread from India, it spread after the time of the Buddha, and first it spread to Sri Lanka quite quickly, then it spread up through Southeast Asia, and about the same time it started to spread up through the northwest of India, through what's now Afghanistan and Pakistan, over the Himalayas onto the Silk Route, the Sanskrit, and went into China, Korea, Japan, sort of from the 3rd century onwards. And then Tibetan Buddhism into Tibet from the 8th century onwards. But by the 12th century, Buddhism was wiped out in India, completely wiped out by invading hordes from the north. So from the 12th century, Buddhism basically didn't exist in India anymore. And now only in the last 50, 100 years is Buddhism starting to develop again in India.
Mahayana came from
Theravada? No. Because these different teachings the Buddha gave in different places and they develop simultaneously. Is it safe to say that the Theravada level of practices are inbuilt in Mahayana? Absolutely. Absolutely.
So those countries had first the Theravada and then they developed
Mahayana? No, because Buddhism spread already to those countries, so then they stayed with the Pali texts.
But if these two different ways of Buddhism.
Well, they're not different. Remember, they're not different. We're not talking about three different ways. We're talking about levels.
Okay, so if it relies on the different teaching of the Buddha, and the Buddha gave his teaching according to the ability of the person in front of him,
right.
Does this mean that a certified teacher would be best to advise us which, is Theravada more suitable to me, or am I Mahayana is better for me?
Correct. I mean, and this is something also that's going to come up a little bit after tomorrow, but, even like Buddhism versus some other tradition or spirituality religion, you know, what is the best tradition? What's the best one? The best one is the one that works best for you. If Buddhism works best for you, Buddhism is the best. If Christianity works best for you, Christianity is the best. If Hinduism is the best for you, then Hinduism is the best. So it's what's best for us. So therefore, we as an individual, and we're very fortunate to have all these different flavours, we can look at each one of those and see which one suits us the best. And of course, then as part of that would be accessibility. There's no point in picking a particular tradition and you think, oh, that one, oh, but no, there's no teachers, there's nowhere that anyone practicing it, then it's not going to work for us. So part of picking that, and we'll talk more about that later, is accessibility. But then we as an individual go into that tradition because that resonates with us and we can have most progress. And then, of course, whatever tradition we start with, in the end, we end up in the same goal.
Is it very Western today to try to get to the highest point, so enlightenment would be the highest thing, but it's not about which is best, but maybe where my mind is at?
Yeah, but to go to university, we first need to go to primary school. We can't go to university as a five-year-old. And that's what we want to do in the West. You know, we look at this and we go, oh, that Theravada Mahayana looks like a lot of work. I just want to do Tantra because it's simple, it's easy, it's quick. And when people say that to Dalai Lama, he cries. Really, he cries because he knows the state of mind that we have, just this craving for grasping, you know. And what we need to understand is it's not going to work. I mean, I know people who came into Tibetan Buddhism 30 years ago, and at that time there wasn't, you know, and in Tibetan Buddhism, all the highest levels are tantric practices, so they thought, oh, well, that's what we've got to do. And so they started doing tantric practice 30 years ago. 20 years later, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed, because there's no basis. And then finally, they go, oh, okay, maybe I need to do some of these other things first. A bit of shamatha, a bit of renunciation and bodhicitta and emptiness. Maybe that's going to help. And so eventually they understand that, but so I really try to encourage that in the beginning, is to understand these are levels, you know. If we want to go to university, we first have to go to primary school, then high school, and otherwise, university, what are we going to do? Nothing, you have no benefit.
So do the Theravada tradition accept the view that they are lower developed than Mahayana?
No, see, this is the wrong way of thinking, you know, is someone who's going to primary school lower developed? No, it's just a stage of development, isn't it? Are they inferior? I mean, everyone has to go through primary school, don't they?
In the end, it's it's a distinction between different developments, right?
No. The Mahayana assertion is wherever you start, Theravada, Mahayana, it doesn't matter, you'll end up in the same place.
If
you follow Theravada, you're inferior and you won't get the result. No.
If you only follow Theravada, you can't reach enlightenment.
Not true.
I mean, if you only believe that only Divine Nirvana is possible, you...
See, what we need to understand is I'm presenting philosophical views. There's a big difference between philosophical view and practice experience. So even though initially we may be following this particular philosophical view, through our practice, we will go beyond whatever philosophical view. If our philosophical view is limited, we'll go beyond that. It's not like if we pick the wrong one, we're stuck. No, it won't happen. We pick the one that works best for us now. And it may be, in fact, one of the philosophical views in Theravada, for us as an individual now, may be much more effective than trying to follow some view from Tibetan Buddhism now. The Tibetan Buddhist view now, we go, well, I don't know what that is, I don't understand, and we put a lot of effort and go nowhere. Whereas the one from one of the other traditions we resonate with and we progress actually faster. We go faster. Yeah. So it's not like one's inferior or superior. It's a matter of what works best for us now, and then as an individual, we'll whatever we start with, we all end up in the same place anyway. Okay.
They're contain universities within them, but it's because if you say one's a primary, one's a secondary, it does.
It's not primary, secondary. It's not.
No, but if you said we have to go to primary school before we go to secondary school, in order for it to be effective,
right?
Each system is complete within.
Yeah, yeah. Mahayana has primary school, secondary school, university. Yes.
So does Theravada.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, what I would like to do is what we've seen here is that the three core areas of practice, actually, even in Tantra Vajrayana, as I said, the basis of Tantra Vajrayana is ethics. Actually, more difficult ethics to follow than in Mahayana, in Vajrayana. And in generation stage practice, part of that is concentration, so part of it is shamatha practice. And of course, the completion stage practice, where we're causing the very subtle mind to become active, is vipassana practice, because we're realizing emptiness. So even in Tantra, we have the same three core areas of practice: ethics, concentration, wisdom. But remember, the entry point, renunciation or bodhicitta, is talking about compassion for ourselves and others. So often we talk about two wings of practice. In Sanskrit, the two wings of practice, the two main aspects of practice, is prajna and upaya. Prajna, of course, is wisdom. Upaya, often translated as method. Method here means method of actions, our interactions with others. So, of course, whenever we talk about our skillful methods, they are to be based on compassion. So often these two wings of practice are called wisdom and compassion. And whatever Buddhist tradition we are following, we need to have both of those in everything we do, wisdom and compassion. Now, unfortunately, when people often come into some sort of spiritual path, they tend to gravitate to one or the other. Particularly in Buddhism, there's a lot of emphasis, of course, on wisdom, on vipassana, to eliminate suffering. So people go, okay, I need to do vipassana, dive in. And so all they do is vipassana. And then often they end up in a lot of difficulty. Because if we're only doing vipassana, often we become very self-absorbed. We often become very disconnected from the world and even become very insensitive to the sufferings of others. And in extreme cases, people become very unethical, because in extreme cases, if they've been doing vipassana for a long time, sometimes they feel, I'm a high-level vipassana practitioner, so everything I do is with wisdom, so everything I do is okay. And they become completely unethical in the name of vipassana. So we don't really want to go there. So we need a balance. But also sometimes people go more into the compassion wing and forget about the wisdom wing. And then often they also find themselves with difficulties. And we see this a lot. For example, if we only go into the compassion wing, then often our compassion practice can become very biased. I'm going to help those people because they're nice people. These horrible, nasty people, I'm not going to help them. In fact, I hope they suffer because they deserve it. So our compassion can become very biased. But also, if we don't work on wisdom, even with the best motivation in the world, sometimes what we do to help not helps, but creates more suffering. So we need wisdom to know how to help. And then also, and this unfortunately happens quite a lot with people who have a lot of compassion and who want to go out and fix and heal the world. We see this a lot in aid workers and social workers, full of enthusiasm, full of compassion. 6 months later, compassion burnout, completely burnt out. Classic example of compassion without wisdom. Here the wisdom, of course, is knowing what we can do to help, what we can't do to help, and the wisdom of knowing when to rest and look after ourselves. In fact, in joyous effort, one of the types of joyous effort is resting when we need to. So if we're not looking after ourselves, how are we going to help anyone else? And then there's another classic example of compassion without wisdom that I think all of us have faced many times in our life. We try to help someone and then they take advantage of us. Classic example of compassion without wisdom. Because if we're trying to help someone and we allow them to take advantage of us, that's not a compassionate thing to do, because we are actually encouraging them to behave badly. This is not compassion. So with wisdom, we are very firm with that person. If they try to take advantage of them, we do not allow that to happen. That's the compassionate thing to do with wisdom. So, therefore, in everything we do, we need compassion and wisdom. And so, of course, in all the Buddhist spiritual paths, we practice compassion and wisdom. And so that's what we're going to look at now today and tomorrow. These two wings of compassion and wisdom. So within Theravada, what we've seen so far is that the wisdom wing, the Vipassana wing in Theravada, is these three marks of existence. We are coming to realize impermanence, dukkha, no self. So dukkha we've already looked at a little bit earlier in the First Noble Truth. Impermanence we've looked at a bit, but I want to talk a bit more about that day after tomorrow. And no self we haven't really talked much about. I want to talk about that more detail tomorrow morning. In the compassion wing in Theravada, we are cultivating what's called the four immeasurables, often known in the Theravada as the four Brahma Viharas. And we're going to look at those, what those four immeasurables are, after I finish this table. But the four immeasurables are basically cultivating loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity towards all living beings. And we'll look at those four in a little bit more detail shortly. So that is the basis of the compassion wing in the Theravada. Mahayana we briefly saw earlier that the wisdom wing, the Vipassana wing, is coming to realize emptiness. That's the main wisdom practice. Realizing no independent me, no independent world. So, of course, we're going to spend a whole day on this wisdom wing tomorrow. We start by looking at this no self, and then the rest of the day, we're going to look at what is this emptiness, how do we go about cultivating that. The compassion wing in the Mahayana is we are building on those four immeasurables to cultivate this aspiration of bodhicitta. So what I'd like to do for the rest of today is focus on the compassion wing. So we'll now look at the four immeasurables, and then this afternoon we'll look at this bodhicitta and how do we go about cultivating that bodhicitta. And then tomorrow we're going to spend the whole day on the wisdom wing, particularly the wisdom of no self and the wisdom of emptiness. So that's the program for the rest of today and tomorrow. So let's now then look at the four immeasurables. So these are four qualities that we are cultivating toward immeasurable sentient beings, meaning towards all living beings. The first is loving kindness, which we've briefly looked at already. A translation of the Sanskrit word maitri, the Pali word metta. So loving kindness, of course, is the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. Or in other words, the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness in its causes. So immeasurable loving kindness is the wish for all living beings to have happiness and its causes.
Unconditional love?
Of course. Conditional is that polluted by attachment. The second quality is compassion. In Sanskrit, Pali, karuna. So in general, of course, compassion is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. So immeasurable compassion, of course, is the wish for all living beings to be free of suffering and its causes. Now, two things, or a couple of things to be mindful of here with loving kindness and compassion, is that we can see that based on the definition of them in Buddhism, both loving kindness and compassion here are not an emotion. They are an aspiration, a wish. They are an aspiration, wish either to have happiness or to be free of suffering. So that's the first thing we need to keep in mind. It's not an emotion. It's an aspiration. It's a wish that we're trying to cultivate. Of course, together with that aspiration or wish, we will have some sorts of emotions, particularly like empathy and so forth. But the actual loving kindness and compassion itself is this aspirational wish. And now the point is how to develop this, how to cultivate loving kindness and compassion to all living beings. It's very much recommended that we cultivate this in stages. That first we cultivate loving kindness and compassion to people close to us, our so-called friends, because it's most easy. And then we start to, once we're comfortable with that, we expand a bit further. Then we start to cultivate loving kindness and compassion to people we don't know very well, the so-called strangers. Once we're comfortable with that, then we start cultivating loving kindness and compassion to people who we find difficult, the so-called enemy. And then from that point, then we can cultivate toward all living beings. So usually in the text, these four stages are mentioned: friend, stranger, difficult person, all living beings. And what we need to be a little bit careful of is the all living beings. Because often these, particularly these two, but all the four, you'll find a little four-line verse. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free of suffering. And of course, it's very easy to say that. You know? May everyone be free of suffering. May everyone be happy. Oh, except, of course, that annoying person at work. They don't deserve it. So one practical way of doing immeasurable loving kindness and compassion in a practical way is may everyone who I come into contact with be happy and be free of suffering, whoever that is. That's a practical way of trying to implement that. In our modern society, I think we need to add one more step right at the beginning that's not normally mentioned in the old Tibetan or Indian texts, and that is to cultivate loving kindness and compassion for ourselves. I think in ancient India and Tibet, people generally felt okay about themselves, so it didn't need to be expressly mentioned. But I think, unfortunately, in our modern society, that's often not the case. Often in our modern society, we have low self-esteem and guilt and even maybe self-hatred. And often we say, you know, I don't deserve any forgiveness or compassion because I'm just a bad person or a hopeless person. So really, that's where we need to start. We need to cultivate loving kindness and compassion for ourselves first, then we can slowly expand it out. Any questions about those two so far?
My only question is that you said it's not an emotion.
No.
And what, so your definition of emotion is?
So, again, generally, actually, there's not really any word that I know of in Sanskrit that is emotion. Because in Buddhism, the main thing is the underlying intention, the underlying aspiration. How that expresses itself in one or another emotional states is not the important thing. It's what's underlying the emotions. That's why we talk about mental afflictions and we talk about the aspirations, the healthy aspirations. That's the key, the most important thing we need to pay attention to. Of course, if we want to talk about an accompanying emotion here, it would be certainly empathy. You know, if we don't have that empathy, then it's going to be difficult to develop that. And that empathy can come actually from the fourth one, equanimity. The third is an empathetic joy is a little bit more an emotion. Empathetic joy, or mudita in Sanskrit and Pali, is a rejoicing in our own and others' virtue and good fortune. So it's a rejoicing in the good things. Rejoicing in the good things we do, rejoicing in the good things that other people do. This also, I think, in our modern society is very important. Because, again, unfortunately in our modern society, We seem to always focus on the negative. And not only that, we focus on the negative with cognitive fusion. And so I think we really need to have a balance in our life. We need to also focus on the good things in life, the good things that we do, the good things that other people do. Otherwise, we have this completely fixed, biased, negative view of everything, ourselves and others. So it's very important to use, to work on this. And I think you'll be doing an empathetic joy meditation with Renato this evening. Very important. Also, of course, empathetic joy, very good antidote for jealousy. Usually if someone else has something good happen to them, we don't rejoice, we're jealous of them. So practicing empathetic joy is very helpful for overcoming jealousy as well. And in the text, because here, remember, even rejoicing is a virtuous action, the mental act of rejoicing. And we need to do virtuous activities, good activities. And often you'll find, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a similar word to that called merit. This idea of merit. And merit is just the result of virtue. So when we talk about accumulating merit, we're talking about doing good things. And often in the text, you know, of course, it seems sort of, often it seems very easy for us to do sort of harmful things, but often it takes a lot of effort to do something good, you know. So it takes a lot of effort to sort of do, accumulate this merit to do good things. And then I think it's a little bit of a, what do you call it, like a carrot, you know, some motivating, what's the word I'm looking for, some
incentive,
that's right, the right word, some incentive to do a good thing without having to put a lot of effort, is that they say that if someone else does a good action and we simply rejoice in that action, we get 10% of the merit. And I think that's a little bit of a carrot incentive. But of course it's true that rejoicing in others' good deeds and our own good deeds is a virtuous thing to do. Then the fourth one.
But I totally didn't get merit by lighting a candle.
By just flicking a thing and lighting candle, I think there's not much merit in that.
No, I thought something about, I mean, I just saw it briefly, but it said...
So all of these rituals, or whatever you want to call them, if they're mechanical, they're just lighting a light. All of these practices, the most important thing is not how well you light a candle, it's what's going on in your mind. And actually, with Renato on the last evening of this course, you'll be doing exactly that. But there's a whole practice around that that can make it a very powerful practice. If we mechanically go and light candles everywhere, I don't think there's much benefit in that. Maybe someone will get a little bit warm from the candle or something, but that's about it. So again, in Tibetan Buddhism, we find a lot of these sorts of practices. And, you know, filling up water bowls with water, lighting candles and so forth. And, of course, if we go along and do that mechanically, okay, maybe we're getting a bit of exercise from putting water in or something, but that's about it. That they're all part of an inner practice. That outer activity helps us to do the inner practice in a deeper way. So it's just like a, what's the word, a heuristic? No. It's just like a physical mechanism to make the practice more powerful.
Like a reminder.
Reminder or a physical aid, a visual aid to help us to appreciate what we're really trying to do in the practice internally. That's the key. The fourth of the four immeasurables, equanimity, in Sanskrit is upeksha, in Pali upekka. And equanimity here is a mind of impartiality, unbiased attitude. It's an even attitude towards everyone. But here, of course, we're not talking about being equally indifferent to everyone. Now, of course, we have a very biased view towards people. And we tend to categorize people in one of three groups simply on the basis of how they affect us. The people around us who seem to support me in my happiness, friend. The people around us who don't seem to affect me in any way, stranger. The people around us who seem to interfere with me in my happiness and maybe seem to cause me suffering, enemy. Once we've categorized people in those three groups, depending on simply how they affect us, of course, then we end up with attachment to friends because they seem to be the source of our happiness. To the stranger, who are not affecting, don't seem to be affecting us anyway, couldn't care less what happens to them. Apathy, indifference. To the enemy who seems to be interfering with me and my happiness, aversion, hostility, anger, maybe even hatred. So we end up with attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, hostility, anger, and hatred to the difficult person. Equanimity is about overcoming that. And the way we can begin to overcome it is to understand that everyone is just like ourselves, wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. We're all stuck in the same situation. We're all equal in this regard. We're all wanting to be happy, all wanting to be free of suffering. And if we can really appreciate that, we're going to start to get a sense of closeness to everyone, understanding we're all stuck in the same situation. And if we can really develop, so that mind of equanimity is a sense of closeness to everyone, not equally indifferent to everyone. And if we can develop that, then it becomes much easier to develop empathetic joy, compassion, loving kindness to everyone. So that equanimity is really the basis of immeasurable loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy. Question down the back.
Is it correct to say that our enemies are our reflection of ourselves?
Could be. In fact, this is a very good point, is I mentioned earlier that often when we have some mental affliction arise, let's say anger, and we don't know how to deal with it, we just sort of stuff it down, suppress it. And part of that suppressing is often denial. Yeah? And then often we project onto other people. And because we're suppressing and denying it, often what we will find is anyone who is displaying that same characteristic, they irritate us because they are reminding us that we have that, even though we're denying it. But so we don't like to be reminded of that. So them getting angry, not with us, but maybe they're getting angry with someone else, it irritates us. So a key point is, if there's someone around us who irritates us, but they don't seem to be irritating anyone else, it's often a sign that what they're doing is what we actually do, but we're not accepting or acknowledging. So check that. If you're getting irritated by someone and no one else seems to be irritated, look inside. Do you have that tendency a little bit that you're not acknowledging? Maybe. Okay. Any questions about the four immeasurables? Separate. I wouldn't use the word separate. Individual?
Several.
Oh, several, sorry. Several, yes, okay.
There have been in the past, Buddha was not the only one, there have been other enlightened ones. And they could exist today in this world. So after rebirth or reincarnation, whatever it is, do they live the same life as us? Because they've broken the cycle of samsara. So do they go through all this again?
No. I mean, what we need to be, and this is something that's going to really become apparent tomorrow, is appearances are illusory, meaning how we see a person versus what they're themselves experiencing maybe is not the same thing. Yeah. For example, if someone is enlightened and they break their arm, someone else who sees them going, oh wow, they're really suffering. But from what we've understood here, that person has no suffering. Of course, they've got lots of sensations in their arm that they have to do something with, but they have no suffering. So their experience is very different from how we see them.
And for us, it appears that they're living in lifetime.
Exactly. In fact, often due to our own, and this is something that's going to, I'm going to talk a bit about day after tomorrow when we talk about a teacher, is that we often project a lot of stuff onto people that's not reality in general. So we often tend to project a lot of stuff onto these, anyone in fact, and we're going to talk about that tomorrow. So any questions about four immeasurables?
No, it's not.
Go on. Technically, they don't go through rebirth. So,
they come back to this life as a new person, right? Not the same person.
No.
So, do they know they're enlightened?
Yes. If you have some doubt whether or not you're enlightened, 100% you're not enlightened. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Run out of time. There was one more thing I wanted to mention about these four immeasurables, but I'll bring that in this afternoon. So now, some discussion topics. And this morning we looked at the fact that the entry point into the Buddhist spiritual path is this mind of renunciation. So the question is, to develop renunciation, do we need to change our lifestyle? To develop renunciation, do we need to change our lifestyle? Second part of the first question, if so, what do we need to change? If so, what do we need to change? And then we also this morning looked at the three vehicles, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. So the second question is, what are the main similarities and the main differences between Theravada, Mahayana and Vajrayana? So what are the main similarities and the main differences between Theravada, Mahayana and Vajrayana? And then we saw that in the Mahayana, the main practices that we need to engage in to achieve enlightenment are these six perfections. So the question is, in what way are each of the six perfections important? In what way are each of the six perfections important? And these six perfections are listed in this order for a particular reason. So the second part of the third question is, why are they presented in this particular order?